This episode of First Person is brought to you by Deep Dish on Global Affairs, an expert explainer podcast going beyond the headlines on critical global issues.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, inside one of the world's worst man-made disasters. Midnight, as April 25th turned into April 26th, 1986, in Ukraine, reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station exploded, triggering an enormous nuclear meltdown. Within days, radiation reached Sweden, and the Soviet Union acknowledged something had happened. The world quickly reacted.
Soviet television tonight accused the Western media of spreading slanderous inventions about the Chernobyl accident.
Madame, Monsieur, bonsoir. Accident dans une centrale nucléaire soviétique.
Auch in der DDR ist der Reaktorunfall ein Thema geworden.
La dirección de la central nuclear de Chernobyl decidió aprovechar una parada planificada.
Two people died that day as a result of the blast. Over 24 more would perish in the days and weeks that followed, and thousands more would eventually get sick with cancer. The fallout would eventually threaten the lives of people in Ukraine, Belarus, and deep into the Soviet Union.
Certainly, there are questions not only about Soviet food supplies, but about the impact of drifting radiation on Poland and Scandinavia, and whether food
had another reactor gone down, nuclear contamination could have spread to a large part of Europe.
There's such a delicate balance between control and catastrophe.
That's Adam Higginbotham. He spent the last decade conducting hundreds of hours of interviews with eyewitnesses to the disaster, from technicians to locals, nuclear apparatchiks to city planners. He pored over reams of letters, memoirs, personal papers, and recently declassified documents.
It was only when I was talking to this pair of experts at Princeton that I realized exactly how marginal the level of control you have of a nuclear reactor is.
In meticulous detail, Higginbotham set out to answer fundamental questions about the catastrophe, the response, the cover-up, and how the disaster may have helped bring down the Soviet Union itself. The result of all this work is a new book titled Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. I recently connected with Higginbotham in New York, where he now lives. Can you explain what happened, even in the construction of the plant, that sort of set the scene for its ultimate destruction?
Yeah, I mean, the path to the accident goes back a very long time and is really laid as a result of the expedience that lay at the heart of the Soviet system, the corners that they had to cut in order to try to get ahead, despite the limitations of the centralized and planned economy. At Chernobyl, it goes back to the very choice of the kind of reactor that they built, because the model of reactor that was chosen to rapidly expand the nuclear industry in the West was a pressurized water reactor, which is cooled with water and moderated with water. And that requires a kind of level of sophisticated tooling that was beyond Soviet capabilities. So they came from behind and they started trying to build reactors to catch up with the West as quickly as possible in the late 60s. And the pressurized water reactor was not available to them. So they went back to this model of reactor that they had originally developed to manufacture plutonium for nuclear weapons, which was graphite moderated and water cooled. Now, if you're manufacturing plutonium, these reactors are fine because they operate at quite low temperatures and low pressure. But in order to convert these principles to a model necessary to generate electricity, you have to increase the pressure and increase the temperature. And in so doing, the whole thing becomes quite unstable. And it was only after they started putting them into mass production that they discovered that there were further problems with the specific design of reactor on top of those that they knew about in principle before they started building them.
So bring us to the night of the accident. It actually was a safety test being taken that night that goes terribly, terribly wrong.
Yes,
what
well, this is more expedience in action. There was one final safety test was supposed to be conducted on the reactor before it was even commissioned. But because the plant staff wanted to get the thing up and running and all the documents signed off before the last day of 1983, in order to get bonuses and to get plaudits from Moscow for having completed their work on time, they decided to skip this last safety test. So the next time they could carry this test out was when the reactor was scheduled to be shut down for regular maintenance, which was in April 1986. What this meant was that it had been online long enough to accrue the maximum amount of radionuclides within the reactor core. It was as dirty and poisonous as it could possibly be in the event of an explosion.
So take us to the night of the explosion itself. Tell us what happens.
So they had decided to schedule this safety test, which was designed to see whether or not, in the event of a power blackout, with all external power to the plant itself being cut off, whether or not the water pumps that kept the cooling water circulating through the reactor core and therefore preventing a meltdown could be kept circulating by other means. And so they'd organized this test and planned it for the day of April the 25th, which was a Friday. And although it had been planned for 2 o'clock that afternoon, they were completely ready for it. And a special team of electrical engineers had come in from Donetsk to oversee what was regarded as principally an electrical test and not really of much interest to reactor physicists. When they phoned the headquarters of the Kiev grid, the operators there told them that they could not take the reactor offline because factories in the area throughout Ukraine were racing to meet their end of month quota deadlines for the end of April. So they refused them permission to begin the test when it had been planned. And so the test got put back until later that night. So what this meant was the people who were expecting to do the test during the afternoon shift just sat around waiting for something to happen. And then the people who arrived for the night shift, which began at midnight over the night of April the 25th and April the 26th, several of them expected that the test had already happened and that all they would be doing was overseeing the cooling of the reactor, which had already been shut down.
And some of them were quite new and inexperienced, weren't they?
The reactor operator who arrived with the midnight shift beginning of April the 26th was Leonid Toptanov, who was extremely well-trained but had only been promoted to this position 2 months previously. And in his job, which was extremely stressful, there are two periods of reactor operation which are more testing than any others. One is startup and the other is shutdown. It's analogous to flying a plane when takeoff and landing are the two most difficult parts. So he had only been on the job 2 months and he had never shut down the reactor before. And because this test had been postponed and because there had been a miscommunication within the plant bureaucracy, the nuclear safety expert who was supposed to be on hand behind Toptanov while he shut the reactor down had been told that the test had already taken place so he could have the night off. So Toptanov ended up having to do this on his own. And it's unclear exactly how this happened, but it seems very likely that he made a mistake very soon after he got to the panel that night and assumed his tasks for the evening under the auspices of the test. And he accidentally almost shut down the reactor before the test had even begun. And in the process of bringing the reactor up to a high enough power level to conduct the test, he and the people around him brought the reactor into a state of extreme instability, which was one of the long cascade of events that set the scene for the accident to happen. And what happened, you know, I said that the path to the accident went back decades, and this path included many of these steps, any one of which on their own would not have resulted in a catastrophic accident. But what happened at Chernobyl on April the 26th was that all of these steps were taken in exactly the wrong way, so that there was this deadly alignment of mistakes and design faults that led directly to the accident. But there was a design fault with the rods that meant that under certain circumstances, for the first few fractions of a second after they were inserted, especially in the case of an emergency stop, reactor power in the core would briefly increase instead of decreasing. So it's as if you're speeding along at 60 miles an hour and you touch the brakes, and instead of immediately slowing, it suddenly jumps to 80 miles an hour before slowing down again. And so they began to conduct the test, and the test was extremely brief. It lasted only 36 seconds. But between Toptanov's mistake, the design faults in the reactor, the existing instabilities of a graphite water reactor, by the time the test came to a halt, the reactor was already in an extremely unstable state. And the final step that was necessary to cause the accident was the insertion of the emergency control rods. And when Toptanov pressed the button to do that, that brought about a runaway chain reaction, which resulted almost instantly in an explosion and the distribution of all of these poisonous radionuclides into the atmosphere.
How quickly did they realize that the reactor had disintegrated? Because at first, they start to tell people that it will be brought back online.
Yes, they did exactly that. Viktor Bruhanov, the director of the station, initially communicated to his superiors in Moscow that everything was under control and that everything would be sorted out soon. And there was no need to evacuate the town of Pripyat, which was 3 kilometers away from the station where 50,000 people lived. And he was ultimately held responsible for this at the trials that were held a year after the accident. But in talking both to him and to the people who were around him at the time, it seems clear that the accident was of such a colossal and unexpected scale that people were simply unable to comprehend what had happened. So Bruhanov just, I think, refused to believe it. He just couldn't comprehend that a reactor that he'd been told that he understood could never explode had actually been completely destroyed in a massive pair of explosions. And similarly, you know, a nuclear expert who was the head of the emergency nuclear plant response team who'd flown down from Moscow the following morning, you know, he overflew the reactor in a helicopter. And you know, he wrote a very detailed memoir about his experience at the scene. And one of the things that he says is that he, a reactor expert, looked out of the window, looked down on the wreckage of the reactor, and had to force himself to believe what he was seeing.
That night, there are a series of measures taken to try to stem the disaster that don't actually, that aren't worthy the lives that are ultimately sacrificed to try to save the reactor.
Yes. So the misunderstandings and refusal to believe what had happened, you know, really began with the idea that there had been an explosion somewhere in the reactor building, but nobody initially thought that the reactor itself had been destroyed. So the initial efforts to cope with what had happened centered on getting cooling water into the core, because the one principal lesson that all reactor operators were inculcated with from the outset was that you must never allow the reactor to run dry, causing a meltdown. This was the worst nightmare of all of the atomic specialists who worked at the plant. So they concentrated all of their efforts on trying to restore a flow of water to the reactor. And so men from the reactor control room went into terribly contaminated areas of the plant in order to try and open these giant valves, which under normal circumstances were so large that they were operated by electric motors. And so they had to turn these giant wheels, you know, 1 inch at a time. And in so doing, exposed themselves to colossal doses of radiation that soon afterwards proved fatal. But there were other efforts carried out by the firefighters who were sent in to fight the fires on the roof of the plant that were caused by debris flying out of the top of the destroyed reactor building. And they too absorbed enormous doses of radiation, depending on where exactly they went. Some, because, you know, I spoke to men who survived. I mean, this is one of the surprises I found in reporting, was just how many of the people who were at the plant that night are still alive today. You know, there's one guy who worked in the control room, Boris Stolyachuk, who was in the control room at the instant of the explosion. So, a lot of that stuff comes from interviewing eyewitnesses.
The other piece that, and you mentioned this earlier, that the decision not to evacuate the town right away comes from the director of the plant. And it takes them several days. And there's something about reading about the children playing in the street, people continuing to be on the banks of the river, walking through town. It's beautiful weather. It's spring. And you understand that they're absorbing higher and higher and higher levels of radiation. Did you talk to many of the members of the town?
I did. I mean, and I should say that although that statement was initially made by the director of the station, the subsequent decision not to evacuate the town quickly was taken by this senior apparatchik, Boris Shcherbina, who came down from Moscow. And according to the people that I spoke to who witnessed his behavior and diary entries from other people who were there at the time, he decided not to evacuate the town because he was afraid of news getting out and that this would prove a colossal technological humiliation to the Soviet Union.
There's something very fascinating about the fact that the Soviets are so concerned with their reputation that they don't actually seek Western help and they try to keep it quiet until they actually literally can't because a radioactive cloud reaches Sweden. And what happens when the Europeans learn about it?
You know, they'd had large nuclear accidents within the Soviet Union before, but they'd happened far enough from the western borders of the USSR that they did not get discovered in the way that this did. Because what happened is this released an enormous cloud of radiation into the atmosphere, and it was kind of snatched away by these high-altitude winds and swept north towards Scandinavia. And so what happened was technicians at a nuclear power station in Sweden, I think more than 500 miles away from Chernobyl, discovered that mysteriously they had radiation alarms going off inside their plant at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning on Monday. And to begin with, they thought that this was the result of a leak from within their own plant because it matched all of the models that they had for leaks from their own reactors. But they could find no evidence of this within the plant. And eventually, as the day wore on, they realized that what was happening was that workers arriving at the plant to begin their shifts were walking through the parking lot where rain had fallen overnight and tracking radiation in from outside in the parking lot into the plant and through the radiation monitors. And that is how the rest of the world discovered that the Chernobyl accident had taken place.
Meanwhile, the town itself is not informed, but the men who'd been on that midnight shift don't return, or not all of them return. But rumors begin to spread. How do people learn about it in the town?
People knew that an accident had taken place. And again, this is something else that was sort of misrepresented in the early accounts. But the truth is that rumors began to spread because it's a big plant and it's a small enough town that everybody knows everybody else. So as you say, you know, when people didn't come home from the midnight shift, people began to ask questions. And word began to spread inside the town that an accident had taken place. The problem was two things. One, that accidents had taken place at the plant before, and nothing bad had ever happened. So there was certainly a part of it that when people began to hear that an accident had taken place, they didn't really think much of it because their experience had taught them that accidents at the plant happened all the time or frequently, and there was never really any major damage as a result in the town. But the other thing was that a lot of people, even the nuclear specialists, still refused to believe that such a major accident as had happened was possible. So there's one guy who worked in nuclear safety at the plant, who that morning was returning home on a train, and other people in his train carriage were discussing a major explosion at the Chernobyl plant. And this guy, who was an extremely experienced physicist, refused to believe that such a thing was possible and became so infuriated by what these rumor mongers were talking about that he almost came to blows in an argument with these other people on the train.
One of the things that I think I hadn't quite understood until I read the book was that the town itself is completely created for the plant. And it's a town of almost 50,000 people. And it's a little halcyonic oasis where people have access to things that other people in the Soviet Union don't have. So it seems to me, I wonder if part of that refusal to believe that something so awful could have happened to this was because it in some ways punctured this perfect dream of town.
Well, I think there may be something to that. And you've also got to remember that, as you said earlier, it was just a beautiful day. And under those circumstances, it's hard to visualize how terrible a threat the invisible, odorless problems of radioactivity pose. You know, when you look out of the window and you just see the river sweeping past and the leaves of the trees waving in the breeze and kids playing in sandboxes, there's a dissonance there between what you can see and what you might know to be possible if you live close to a nuclear plant.
The men who are on site right away, the firefighters and the other men who start trying to cool the reactor with water, they begin to have extreme reactions to radioactivity. What are those reactions?
In the initial phase, depending on the level of your exposure, you begin vomiting and you have headaches and then develop a high fever. Then a latency period sets in and you might feel fine again for a certain period of time, depending on the level of your exposure, and then you become very sick. And ultimately, if you've been exposed to a high enough level of radiation, it will kill you.
The burns that some of these men receive, even for weeks afterwards, don't even emerge right away.
No, that's right. So one of the many differences between thermal burns that you might get in an ordinary fire and radiation burns is that thermal burns from a fire are very bad to begin with and then gradually heal up as the body's immune system begins to heal the damage. But what happens with radiation burns is that they gradually emerge and grow worse and worse and worse. And because the body's immune system is compromised, this is one of the things that in severe radiation injuries leads ultimately to death.
And many of these men are taken to something called Hospital Number 6 in Moscow. What was that?
That was a specialized radiological hospital that was set up to treat people with radiation injuries that was organized under the aegis of what was known as the Ministry of Medium Machine Building, which was the sort of misleadingly bland title.
How quickly did families learn of where their loved ones were?
Well, initially, they weren't told anything at all. So the worst affected victims of the accident, the first 120 or so men and women, were flown to Moscow and sent to Hospital Number 6. But none of their relatives were told where they'd gone because, you know, a blanket of secrecy was thrown over the whole thing. And the KGB had indeed cut off the telephones by this point. And it wasn't until several days later that many of them discovered the ultimate destination of where their relatives had gone.
And when they finally evacuate the town, one of the things that is striking is that some people are seeded into these villages that don't have any telephone access. They're off the grid.
Yes. I mean, when the evacuation takes place on Sunday afternoon, it was done with extraordinary efficiency. It was one of the few aspects of the handling of the disaster that worked as it should have done. They evacuated at least 27,500 people from the town in less than 3 hours. But the plan called for these people to be just distributed into what at that time were regarded as safe areas, far enough from the plant and from the town to be outside the bands of contamination. And that just meant that they were, you know, driven into these towns and villages, often in the middle of nowhere, without access to telephones or other forms of modern communication, and just billeted with, you know, the workers of collective farms.
And most of them are told that they're only going to be gone for a couple of days. They don't actually take all that much with them.
They were deliberately misled into thinking that they would only be gone for a few days. An evacuation announcement was broadcast over the local radio network in Pripyat, which did not explicitly say how long they would be gone for, but implied by telling them that they only needed to take important documents and food and clothes necessary for a few days.
And all their pets are left behind.
Yes. I mean, the reason that the Ukrainian Minister of Energy at the time explained to me for this misleading of the population was at least in part to make sure that they didn't overcrowd the available transport that had been laid on to get them out of the town with their belongings. So what he said to me very cynically was, well, you know what our people are like. If we told them that they were leaving forever, they'd have tried to bring their furniture with them. And for similar reasons, they couldn't bring pets, but also because by that time, the fur of cats and dogs in the town had become contaminated with radioactive dust. One guy from the plant told me that his son had disobeyed the rules and taken the family cat with him on the bus. And that when they stopped for a rest break, his son and the cat both got off the bus. And the cat went and sat on top of one of the tires of the bus, where it was extremely warm, while the rest stop took place. And then when his son got back on the bus, he retrieved the cat and then put it back on his lap. And this guy, Georgi Reitman, told me that his son's health has never been the same as a result of that.
Because the child had been exposed to radiation as a result of the cat and the wheel.
Yes, because the cat had sat in the radioactive dust that was caked on the wheel of the bus, and then immediately afterwards had sat in his lap for the entire duration of the evacuation journey.
If you like First Person, you'll love Deep Dish on Global Affairs, a weekly podcast going beyond the headlines on critical global issues. Each episode has new guests, like Israeli security experts explaining cyber terrorism, or Hollywood producers covering China's influence over the U.S. box office. Deep Dish describes what's happening, why it matters, and what to watch as the story unfolds. Subscribe to Deep Dish on Global Affairs today, wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the more fearsome scenarios is something called the China Syndrome. What's that?
The China Syndrome was originally named by American nuclear engineers who visualized a scenario in which nuclear fuel inside a nuclear reactor would begin to melt down, and it would become so hot that it would burn through the concrete base plate of the reactor and then continue on through the foundations of the reactor building itself and into the earth below and keep going until it emerged on the other side of the world in China. Now, you only have to look at a globe to realize that this is geographically impossible because China is not actually on the other side of the world from Idaho, for example. But it's also geologically and physically impossible. But the Soviets had very real and justified fears of something like this happening, which was that as the reactor in Unit 4 began to melt down, it would form this super hot sphere of radioactive material, of what was subsequently named as corium, the melting core of the reactor. And they feared that it would melt through the base plate of the reactor and through the foundations of the building. And they feared two things. One was that it would burn through until it reached these sealed steel tanks, part filled with water, that lay directly beneath the reactor as part of one of its safety systems. And that if this super hot nuclear material reached this water, it would cause an enormous steam explosion that would actually prove even larger, potentially, than the first explosion that destroyed the reactor. And that would destroy not only what remained of reactor number 4, but also potentially destroy the other three reactors, which were also part of the complex. And that this would form the basis of what would effectively be a huge dirty bomb, which would distribute an unimaginable amount of radioactive material into the atmosphere and poison a far larger area of the Soviet Union and Western Europe. And they began making preparations to evacuate people not merely from the 30-kilometer zone around the plant, but 500 kilometers around the plant, which would have included the cities of Kiev and Minsk and millions of people. That was the first concern. The second was that if it got through those tanks without incident, then the nuclear fuel would then melt through the very foundations of the building and into the earth until it reached the water table. And the water table beneath the plant was connected to the River Pripyat and to the River Dnieper, which fed the Kiev Reservoir and then went on to the Black Sea. And so it would poison the drinking water supply of a huge proportion of Ukrainian citizens, and then subsequently everybody who drew water or fished in the Black Sea. So those were the concerns about the China Syndrome, which ultimately proved out to be quite well-founded, as it did melt through several layers of concrete beneath the reactor itself and was only stopped just before the foundations of the building.
You imply towards the end of the book that Chernobyl itself helped unravel the Soviet Union, or at least that's how I read it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, not financially, although it cost an enormous amount of money. But I think the more significant is the effect that it had on Mikhail Gorbachev's policymaking. Because, you know, he had announced glasnost and perestroika in the months leading up to the accident, but he was moving quite slowly. And it wasn't until he realized, as a result of what happened in Chernobyl, exactly the scale of the lies that had been delivered to him. And he realized how corrupt even the nuclear state, one of the most prestigious parts of the Soviet scientific community, the Ministry of Media and Machine Building and the nuclear complex that lay behind it, he realized that even this was deeply corrupt, and that the leaders of the Ministry of Media and Machine Building and the scientists of the Institute of Atomic Energy in Moscow, you know, they had all misled him consistently. And he realized at that point that the whole state was corrupt at a level that needed fixing very fundamentally. And this encouraged him to plunge on with reform much more deeply and more swiftly than perhaps he would have done otherwise.
What is it like visiting Chernobyl now?
Well, it's frightening. I would be lying if I said otherwise. But I've been there a lot, so I've kind of got used to it. But, you know, when I first went there, I went there in the dead of winter. And going there at that time of year, it seems like a truly post-apocalyptic landscape. You have these lines of high-tension power pylons marching off into the distance, but the cables connecting them are all downed and kind of dangling to the ground. And there are abandoned towns and disused rail yards, and the plant itself is an extremely forbidding place. And for years, I only went there in the winter. But then, exactly on the 30th anniversary of the accident, I went back to Pripyat on April the 25th. And just like April the 25th and the 26th of 1986, it was an unseasonably warm day, and it was absolutely beautiful. A clear blue sky, all the trees are in bloom, there was a gentle breeze. And in Pripyat, you know, it's a deserted town that's become a ghost town. It was completely overgrown. There are trees sprouting from the steps and inside apartment buildings. But that day, I was walking through the town doing reporting for the book with a guide to the zone and with my translator. And I remember very clearly that we're walking through one of the giant courtyards in the middle of some of the apartment buildings in Pripyat. And at some point when I wasn't looking, they turned the corner. And I discovered that I was alone in this courtyard that was overgrown with trees and grass. And at that point, it was completely silent and I felt completely alone. And I got a sudden feeling of what it would be like to be the last man on Earth. And that also became totally terrifying. And I could not wait to find my colleagues fast enough after that.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about midnight in Chernobyl.
Thank you.
That's journalist Adam Higginbotham. His new book is titled Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs. We had additional production help this week from Ben Soloway. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I'm your host.
If you like First Person, you'll love Deep Dish on Global Affairs, a weekly podcast going beyond the headlines on critical global issues. Subscribe to Deep Dish on Global Affairs today, wherever you get your podcasts.